Well, hello everyone. Welcome to the Gundam Explained show live. I am Adam Blue, and joining, as always, luckily this time, is Stephen Minai Hatter. What's up, man?
Not a lot, you know, trying to stay dry. We've got thunderstorms here in this area, so if all of a sudden my video drops out, you guys know what happened.
Yeah, don't worry. It's not like any technical difficulty. That doesn't happen. So
yeah, that never happens here.
No, cool to do this. If you guys missed it, Steven's show yesterday was really cool because we were, like we do a lot where we break down video game stuff, we kind of went a little deeper than normal in terms of like Gundam games, but like what is like the ultimate experience? Not necessarily the best controls, but what gives you that full experience? So if you haven't checked that out.
Yeah, well, it's sure. So funny because you say like deeper than usual, and it's like, yeah, deeper than usual for like the normal Gundam game discussion. But like you and I tend to take any superficial topic and then, you know, maybe it's because I'm so pedantic, we break it down to like the very fine details.
You're exactly right. And I think that's what's really cool about our collaboration, because we're both in that same mindset when it comes to gaming, where there's so much we know and we love to like get into the more technical, deeper aspects of it. And a lot of times we come up with things we never even thought of. So
yeah, for sure. And it like, I think that it informs some of the work that you and I do.
Yeah, no, that's exactly right. So yeah, anyway, check that out. If you haven't, you know, check all the links below. And then there's that other thing I haven't been promoting a lot. There is a Stream Elements, I think it's called, or Streamlabs, Stream Elements link. The idea is to see people from the community that are watching this that want to have like specific topics discussed or a thing discussed. You can send them in that way, and then I make it a segment during the show. So who knows when that will happen, but we'll see. So far in the chat, Xionic Shadow, Contra 0083, Johnny Tacoma, Barry BB, howdy y'all. Good to see everybody.
Yeah, I mean, can we get the Konami code in the chat right now? I'm gonna know if you guys cheated and went and looked it up.
Why is that? How would you know?
Ooh, well, I guess latency would probably be an issue, right?
Oh yeah, there you go. Good. Yeah. So yeah. But there's up, down, left, right, A start or B A start, or up, up, down, down, left, right.
Yep. A B select start.
Yeah, there you go. Then if you played Mortal Kombat on the Genesis, there's A B A C A B B to unlock the blood code. I've remembered that.
Because that one was more important, let's be honest. Like infinite lives in Contra or blood in Mortal Kombat. Yeah, I think exactly. I'd rather have blood in Mortal Kombat.
No, yeah, that's true. No, but yeah, cool show today. We're going to talk about some like what's some Mount Rushmore things in Gundam, and it, you know, part of this too is to kind of get an idea of what are cool elements about Gundam, so then when you are talking to people about Gundam, like you can kind of bring these things up in conversation. You know, like if you're talking cool scenes in movies, cool scenes in shows, like, you know, a lot of times when I want to tell someone like why Gundam is so cool, it's like, okay, what should I pick from? Should I AU, UC? Should it be modern UC? Should it be old? And it's like, I don't know. Should it be Amuro stuff? Should it be side story?
And you know, it's funny that you mentioned this because I guess another term for, you know, Mount Rushmore would be like tentpole moments, right? Like,
oh yeah.
Yeah. Exactly. So there's like a big, I guess, hullabaloo going on Twitter right now about like, Gundam shows that saved Gundam, right? So like, oh, you know, yeah. G Gundam kind of brought Gundam out of the dark ages in the 90s, and then Gundam Seed brought Gundam out of the dark ages in the 2010s. And so it's interesting when you put it in that context of like, okay, if we were to have like the Mount Rushmore of Gundams, like would it be those moments in the history of the franchise that kind of created the resurgence of popularity?
I know what you mean. So it would be something like maybe the original release of Gundam, and probably the next, I don't know if the next, what would, maybe that you were talking about. Yeah, G Gundam coming around, and then Seed, and then even Witch for Mercury, because that kind of made like their stock shoot up a whole lot.
Unicorn was a big thing, as I hate to admit it. Like,
no, you know. But that's funny because I always say this, man, if I was into Gundam before Unicorn came out, and then I watched Unicorn, it would blow my mind. Like, looking back at all, it's connected. Like, and I like that a lot. Like, even Hathaway. Like, I wish I was super into Gundam before I saw Hathaway, because Hathaway, the fact that they keep things mature, you know?
Yeah.
And I guess, you know, that's a... I'm trying to think of it, because sometimes, and we're going to talk about something here in a second that's a little surprise I was teasing you about. Because sometimes I try to figure out, what is it about something that I like? Oh, is it because this just happens to be more adult and more mature? Maybe that's part of it. But the other part of it is because it's being explored in a story that then makes the kid action a lot more interesting for an adult, because I know what these characters had to go through to get to certain action scenes. You know, like with the X-Men, when I was talking about, oh, that old X-Men show is so good. And it's like, but oh, is it just because, yeah, these are issues in society and adult themes. And on the surface, it's like, well, that doesn't make it good. But what it is they speak on it in such a way that makes the action much more of like a at stakes.
It creates stakes. Yeah. It creates stakes that I think that both adults and children can understand. I don't think that you have to be an adult to understand that, you know, the Mutant Registration Act was discriminatory and wrong. Right.
Yeah. Exactly. But as a kid, I'm not, especially that time, I'm not like linking it to race, because I remember the moment I realized race was a thing. And that was like maybe middle school to high school, when like certain jokes you're not allowed to say. It's like, well, why? Because that's racist. What does that mean? Oh, because it's hateful to a group of people. It's like hate to a group of... I just remember in middle school, that kind of like becoming a reality. And it's so weird, like that innocence we have before.
Yeah, there's like a social training that goes on.
Yeah.
And what's interesting is that like children are not born with those inbuilt prejudices. The adults have the prejudices, and then they almost, in a way, we almost coach it to children, because we say, hey, you're not allowed to say that. And it's like, children don't understand why. And it's like, well, because we think it's wrong. It's like, it doesn't even have anything to do with the children's perspective.
I remember when my oldest was super, super young, Moana came out, he wanted the costume, and I forgot if he ended up getting it or not, but then I just remember, it was around the same time the costumes were coming out, and I was still using Facebook, and I remember a friend of mine was posting how, like, it's wrong that they make this costume, no one should be wearing it if, you know, they're not of that color. And I was like, do kids even know when they're wanting to be that character? What the color doesn't matter. Like, and so I feel like, yeah, that was like this systemic thing that happened, where we're kind of teaching people to be like, oh, did you know some people hate them? So there's a reason. And it's like,
yeah. Isn't it funny that like almost the knee jerk effect of trying to prevent prejudice creates the prejudice because you're overcorrecting for it.
And I remember this clearly too. This was in the 90s. There was a movie that came out in the 90s that had some big name actors. And I want to say it was like five or six of them. And they were all, I think they were playing gay characters. I didn't watch it or anything. I forget what the name of it was, but anyway, I just remember when that came at was being like promoted, then hearing, I don't know if it was on news or somehow like, oh, ew, gay. And then learning, you know, what that was, and being like, oh, that's gross. But I mean, like, I don't care, because at the same time, it reminded me of, and while this isn't a big issue, it allowed me to relate, where in elementary school, I didn't talk about video games a lot, because people would normally be like, oh, you're a nerd, you play games. So for me, the immediate reaction to a group being judged by something, so people didn't like them, made me feel offended. Because I was
gamers, like, still the most oppressed.
No, but so I find that interesting, because that was,
I'm just kidding.
No, but that was like self taught to me to sympathize, I guess is the word, to be like, I understand how people could be treated, so I want to make sure I'd never think that, you know.
Yeah,
but not everyone gets that learning as they grow up,
you know? And it can be hard for people to articulate those ideas in the most literal terms, which, going back to what you said, it's like, that's where the value of something like the X-Men comes into play. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Is by creating a fiction around it where it's not directly tied to real world discrimination. you can teach the idea that discrimination is wrong without tying it specifically to groups of people in real life. And that way you put it on the viewer to, you know, make those connections.
That is excellent that you said that, because you did kind of then answer my question, because I kind of started like, why does it matter that it's adult themed? And then I'm getting this action. Well, it's because we can kind of take a look at real things that are not good. Like, we can agree it's not good. That's a real good culprit for the action in the story. But also, if we see these things in real life, it can kind of equip us to how we should properly act. So,
yeah. And I recently saw a video on YouTube about, you know, where activists can cause more damage than good. And the key takeaway from the video was, you know, when you create a dichotomy in someone's mind where everyone believes that they're a good person at their core, right? But when you create a dichotomy in their mind where it's like, okay, you claim to be a good person, that's fact A, and then, but you don't recycle. Let's say that's like the example, like, oh, you don't recycle. Only good people recycle, and therefore, fact A is incorrect. You are not a good person. The problem with that approach to trying to correct someone's behavior is that there is a natural lizard brain reaction that says, wait, did you just tell me I'm not a good person because I don't recycle?
Yeah.
And then, they're going to reject the idea. They're going to reject your premise. Whereas what X-Men does, and this is where credit is totally due to Stan Lee, Steve Ditko, all the folks at Marvel Comics that made X-Men great, is they abstracted it. They're not saying, hey, good people don't discriminate. You do discriminate, therefore you're a bad person. They said, hey, discrimination's wrong. We're not telling you whether or not you discriminate, but we're creating examples of it that are abstracted so that you can view what incorrect behavior looks like.
And what's cool about that is then we see conflict between the characters that are the discriminated, because the conflict is, how do we go about? Because it is not an absolute of like, okay, then we kill everyone that doesn't agree. It's, you know.
And that's the best part, is Charles Xavier is like, no, we need to treat these people with grace and compassion because they're afraid of us. And that's why we need to try even, it's like we need to double down on being good in order to correct their misperceptions of us.
Yep. Excellent. Excellent.
Good stuff.
I'm glad we got into this because it kind of helps me. Well, it's like, why should someone care? Yeah, if something's adult themed or something. But this leads right into our surprise for today. At least it's a surprise to me. And Lucas Garrett has always been on this, to where then I made a video Monday in the woods about Exo Squad.
Guys, hey, shout out to Lucas Garrett. Long
this
time.
Show is so good. This is like episode 5, and it just starts playing badass music, and then everyone's just like battling in space. But it's not, it's even though you can say, the animation's not that great, you can see
there's a lot of detail in there.
Yeah, that's right. Like, there's a lot of detail. You can see what they're conveying. It's like it's showing it instead of just action for action. It's like, okay, this happens, and then this happens, and then that happens because that happens. It's like this just went on and on and on with action. And was it this episode? I think it was the one after this. So anyway, like I will watch this and then watch the next. And then I was like, no, I don't want to watch too many at once. And I'll go back, because there's one part I had to replay. It was on the next episode where there's this like operation where they're trying to sneak in. So they all use drop pods to come down. One of them gets hit with debris and goes flying off and blows up like at the beginning of the episode. So it's like, just they're like, doing, oh shit. Like, this is tragic. This character just died. And then later in the episode, I'm going to try to see if I can.
Well, and before you skip ahead, like, I just want to say we're 10 seconds into the episode and you're already seeing like the toy gimmicks, like the grappling hook with the tether cable and stuff like that. This is, you know, it's like, it's obviously like, this is not just another mech show.
Yeah, exactly. And that's the thing, like, I keep coming back to, it is, that's the look of it. It's like someone might look at this and be like, it looks like a, you know, a kid's show. It looks like toys, without realizing, well, that was the way to sneak in this awesome story. So then later in the episode, and I forget, is it around this part where these people look like they're going to die? Things a little later. Like the good guys just come in and completely. Let's see if it. Yeah, I think it's coming up here in a second. Yeah, they just come in over where there's a like a political rally, and they're just coming and they're just killing everybody. Like these are the good guys, and they're killing all the people that are having this like political rally, and it's like holy crap, and they're trying to take out the guy.
Is this a Kent State University thing where it's like,
but no, I'm telling you, like, you know, people have said that every once in a while, how, no, it is a good show. You should watch it. Yeah. Even though people don't talk about it a lot, but I'm 8 episodes in and this show is fantastic. So I suggest anyone to watch it. It's on Peacock. It's also on the Internet Archive, FYI.
I recently discovered that like that old show, Reboot is just being streamed on YouTube. Yes.
Like. I know that same channel is streaming Jackie Chan movies 24/7. So I've been watching that. It's like the Toku Shoutsu or something like that.
Yeah. Brilliant. Yeah.
Reboot was great.
That was another show that like, you know, again, to that same effect, that it had these, you know, mature themes without being over the top. I think that a lot of people think, I'm glad that Ian brought this up in chat. There was a reboot of Reboot on Netflix. Yeah. Netflix is guilty of like, just because something has mature themes, it has to have lots of swearing and like at inappropriate times too. Like, don't get me wrong. I think that a well-placed like, oh fuck, that's
right.
Great. But like, you know, you don't have to have characters that just kind of spew off curse words because for the heck of it. Like, I think that mature themes can exist without swearing.
Yeah. You know, I feel like swearing is a tool that could be used. Like there's this awesome, have you played the game Vanquish? It was like on 360 PS3, third person Japanese action game. Really good. And it's kind of a mature themed game, but kind of typical action gamey, but it's just this one part that I wasn't expecting. Your character like gets on this like platform that shoots him out into the sky and he's going really fast to the enemy. And then all of a sudden you just see hundreds of missiles like come out to him and he just goes, oh, fuck me. And I just like busted out laughing. Cause then you go and fight and it's cool stuff like that.
Yeah. When it's well-timed and well-delivered, and that's the thing. It's like, you know, think about like the Netflix Witcher series, right? There's that scene when Geralt realizes that he's going to have to fight all these townspeople and he's probably going to kill most of them because, you know, he's the Witcher and he's just like, oh fuck, you know? Okay, cool. But the problem is that moment is then deflated by the fact that the rest of the show is full of swearing. So it's like,
I find that interesting how much sometimes swearing is in stuff where it's like it totally loses its meaning. Yeah. It's we're just filling, and it loses the impact too. If you're really trying to, it's that. And I don't know if everyone will agree with me. I don't even agree with myself on this, but sometimes movies or shows or action movies will be over the top gory when it's like, ah, okay, it didn't need to do it then. Maybe they could have waited, you know, something like The Boys. That's kind of its thing. But sometimes I forget what I was watching the other day. It was just an action movie or show, but I don't know. Just like all the fight scenes were like something bloody and horrible happening. And I was like, yeah, I didn't think that was going to be in this movie and that's fine. But then it does this thing where sometimes it's like, okay, then the action is just more goofy, campy fun when it's too gory. If I was kind of taking the character seriously in that situation, then it's like, well, you know, that's what I was saying. I don't know if I agree with myself because growing up, I was like, man, I love gore, blood and guts everywhere. But
yeah, I mean, I think that it depends on the medium, right? Like if something like The Evil Dead, where it's like, yeah, there's a lot of gore in The Evil Dead, but it lends to that campy feel. Like that's part of the allure.
Exactly.
Something like Saw or Hostel. Those are also very gory, but I think that those are implemented more for shock value. But the problem is the more you see that stuff, then you're desensitized to it. So it's like, oh, he only cut his foot off? Come on. Like, I'm used to watching people cut off above the knee. Like,
well, yeah, and that's interesting because, like, Army of Darkness is one of my favorite movies of all time. And Sam Raimi, so good. Yeah, he makes a movie where he just scales back the gore. Obviously, he wanted, you know, a PG-13 theatrical release, but you could see that craft, that filmmaker knew when and where within the same trilogy to take away the gore. Yeah, sure, it had that giant blood fountain that came out of the pit at the beginning, but other than that, that movie has very little gore and it's still amazing. And even in that, I think Bruce Campbell says fuck once. He's like, get the fuck out of my face. And they added that in because they knew they were going to get a rated R rating on it. Okay. And then I heard the only reason Army of Darkness is rated R is because the last two movies are Evil Dead and Evil Dead 2.
Oh, so they did it like contextually. Like,
yeah. Just and I kind of get it because Evil Dead 1 and 2 are like extreme movies, you know, and it was like me when I was a kid, I see Army of Darkness and I think I had already seen Evil Dead, but it was like, I think my older half brother was like, oh, you know, Army of Darkness is a sequel to Evil Dead. And it's like, what?
Like, wait a second. There's more. And it so has young. More curse words.
And then I remember one time and I forget what grade I was in, but I drew the picture where in Evil Dead 2, I think it is like the camera is on the hand, like coming down as blood is coming down the camera lens, which yeah. To me that was a neat trick, and I would draw that in class and the teacher would be like, maybe not that much.
Well, and what's hilarious is then that went on to become like a staple of first person shooter games, right? Is like yeah. the blood that creeps in yeah. around the camera lens,
and that is just normal for kids, 12 year olds that are it is kind of interesting yeah. actually to think about how games do get away with more stuff that PG-13 or movies yet couldn't do, you know, in the early 90s. And yeah, all that stuff changes with time and, you know,
yeah,
you know how it goes. There we go. Contra groovy. But Raimi found loopholes like off-colored blood. Great. Yeah, that is actually a good point. Love Sam Raimi. And, you know, he did the Doctor Strange 2, which for what that was actually pretty cool, just because Sam Raimi, it's almost like Disney's like, okay, you got to make this movie, and then Sam Raimi just added his stuff throughout, like Doctor Strange pretty much being a deadite, you know, like coming out of the ground being a deadite. I was like, that's sick.
Yeah, I mean, it's unfortunate because like the whole MCU has become this intertwined thing where it's like you can't have one movie without referencing the entire filmography of Marvel. So it would have been interesting to see what Sam Raimi did if he had just been given a totally blank slate without saying like, hey, you need to make sure to tie it into this show and make sure that it ties into this movie.
Yeah.
Like, if there's so much, like, I don't even know how to describe it because there's the term sequel baggage, right? Like yeah. Zeta Gundam suffered from sequel baggage. But like the MCU has like, it's like 4D baggage.
You know what it is? It's conditioning the audience. Because it could be that people don't really care to see a movie, but then they figure they have to, and then really they don't care when they're watching it, you know? Yeah. But it's like, oh, you have to. I even heard there's going to be an Avengers movie with 60 returning heroes. I mean, I don't know. I think after the Deadpool and Wolverine, it's going to kind of tell us like what people really want going forward, I hope. You know, yeah. I don't know. I don't know. I just really want a Gundam live action movie. There we go. That would be the next, what were you saying? Not Mount Rushmore, but the next,
like tentpole. Yeah.
Tentpole. Would be that live action movie getting out there.
Yeah. You know, it was interesting because, I was having a conversation on Discord the other day where we were talking about like video game budgets and Hollywood budgets came into play because did you know that they used the same computers and software when they made Crash Bandicoot as they did in the movie Jurassic Park?
Wow. You would think
those computers, like those silicon computers, were like $100,000 a pop, like in the 90s.
Because that's okay. So let's say Jurassic Park was probably in prime 92 in terms of like them working on it.
Yeah.
And then what, Crash, like 95, 96?
Probably. Yeah, like 96, because the PlayStation came out, what, 97, 98?
Yeah, something like that. So what's interesting then is back then you were seeing where it takes multiple years before newer technology comes out, which I think pretty much, I bet every MCU movie that comes out is a newer computer software technology.
Oh, yeah. And so it's crazy to me that, like, you know, Jurassic Park had a staff of less than 1,000 people working on the movie, and they were using computers that were it was $100,000 for the computer, and then another $75,000 for the graphics processing software that they used to create, like, the CG dinosaurs. So you're talking about, like, $200,000 per workstation, and yet that movie was still only $69 million to produce, which was, like, adjusted for inflation, is about $129 million today. The Avengers Endgame movie was $365 million to produce. So it still costs, like, almost three times as much as Jurassic Park would cost to make today. And they had a staff of over 5,000 people working on this movie.
Yeah.
So when you put it in terms like that, and of course, by the way, you can get a computer for like $2,000 that is like really high performing computer.
Yeah.
So when you put it in terms like that, it's like, I want a team of like 200 people to make a Gundam movie that costs $60 million. And I think that it will come out at the quality of like a Jurassic. How much did Godzilla Minus One cost to produce? That had a really low budget too, didn't it?
Yeah. Wasn't it like, $15 million or something? Let's see if, I'm pulling it up right now. Although,
and the only reason I bring all this stuff up is it's like, you know, you look at the MCU and you look at these Marvel movies and it's like these huge budgets. And then like,
that's why, dude, that's why I feel like it has to be money laundering. Even if it's as simple as let's just pay everybody something, like that's just too much, you know, like that's, I don't know.
Well, my nephew needs a job, so we're going to have him be a gaffer and like...
and I don't know if it works that way, but it is crazy because you're right. Godzilla Minus One is a good example. Here's another good example. So the director, Gareth Edwards, and this is related to what you're talking about, because you know he's going to be directing the new Jurassic Park movie.
Right.
And it's going to have under $100 million budget, I think.
Wow.
Wasn't that the word? And Scarlett Johansson, Mahershala Ali are going to be in it. So
great actors.
Yeah. So Gareth Edwards, you know, did Rogue One, Godzilla, which I love. He also did that recent one, Creator. And the big thing about that was, I think I did a video about this, but it's how he shoots movies like you would shoot a movie. But the idea is you add CGI to things later, which I think is the best way to go about it. Because if you're making a shot for CGI, it might not come across, and I see this a lot, it doesn't come across as like realistic and grounded, but when you're shooting things for real and then adding like no green screen, no blue screen, you just shoot for real, add the CGI. And so I'm sure Universal saw what Gareth Edwards did with Creator and they're like, yes.
And more of that, please.
Yeah. Because that's the perfect thing Hollywood needs right now, where they're not paying or they're not, their budgets aren't so big, but they can do this for giant IPs. Because even the last Jurassic World movie, which was not good at all, made over $1 billion.
Yeah. You know?
So if they're doing that again, low budget, but great directors and great actors, this next Jurassic Park movie could be amazing. And that's the thing. So Jordan Vogt Roberts, who did King Kong Skull Island after Gareth Edwards Godzilla, so that's the only connective tissue there. He could hopefully have those sensibilities too. So I would just say if it happened to be where he no longer is directing the movie, I think you would get Gareth Edwards. The only thing with Gareth Edwards, I would say, is you have to have someone else write the characters. That's the only thing. Mm. As much as I like Gareth Edwards movies, and even he writes the characters to go through things that are interesting, it's just the dialogue and the pacing sometimes doesn't.
And that's the thing about both Edwards and Vogt Roberts, right? Is like, you know, they both did kaiju movies, and compared to like Minus One, like the story is less, it's more action driven and less character driven, right? Like Minus One is a very character driven movie,
yeah,
despite being a kaiju movie. Mm-hmm. Whereas Skull Island and Gareth Edwards Godzilla are, you know, I don't want to say smash them ups. They do have, you know, a story to them, but like they're definitely not on par with what you see in Minus One.
And you know, that's a good point you bring up, because but even before Shin Godzilla, which I love too, that is where it's driven by the world Godzilla would be in. You know, like modern day, where we're trying to react to disasters. How do we do that? But before that, a lot of the Godzilla movies would just be loaded with bad special effects, because that at that point, I think they were like, Godzilla films were successful by being schlocky.
Yeah.
And then I think they realized, well, we can make it look realistic and just have a low budget. And it works, and it has with Shin Godzilla and then Minus One. But okay, so you know what? That was a good discussion. Thank you. I wasn't planning on this filmmaking discussion, but I love it.
It's always, anytime that we can bring up the Gundam live action movie and, you know, keep that bug in everybody's ear.
Yes, because hey, it's got to get made. If I have to do it, I will. So next up, we are going to actually talk about, these like moments that happen in Gundam that are like, the Mount Rushmore moments or whatever. So this is from DeGoose. Goose,
haven't seen you in a while.
I know.
You're doing well, buddy.
You must be busy. But let's all be honest right now. Best moment goes to Amuro for pushing basically a space mountain away from Earth with space magic in the new Gundam. I think that counts as a Mount Rushmore moment.
Yeah, I mean, let's face it, that is where the series ended.
Yeah. Okay. Except, you know, there's F-91. Come on. No. Okay. This is from, what does it say? Fat Tiger. Okay. 6957. My favorite moments are both from 0079. Number one is the orbital entry scene, which, you know, if we just take that by itself, I remember when I first saw that and I was like, wow, that's really cool. Very sci-fi and trying to like be realistic, which I didn't think they would do. The Gundam barely surviving while the Zaku explodes really hammers home that mobile suits are not invincible. One of Seed's greatest sins, other than that whole of Seed Destiny. Really?
Come on now. Seed Destiny is. No,
is recreating that scene, but doing it badly. Oh, that's interesting. That's right. I remember the callbacks.
Yeah, and that was a huge moment in 0079, right? Yeah. There are some very specific moments in that series where you really are shown that the Gundam is special. It's like the beam saber. Oh, wow, this is the first time we've seen a beam saber weapon. The beam rifle. Hey, he has a warship class rifle on a mobile suit. This is insane. And then the fact that the Gundam then entered the atmosphere without, you know, any kind of protection, and it blew everyone away. This was something that people had not seen before. And I think that that's one of the things, maybe it's an advantage that the original series had over later installments, that like they could do so many firsts. But that moment that Char realized like, oh, we didn't kill him.
That was a good one. In context of everything, I like how you brought up how really it's really still showing off the Gundam's power at that point.
Yeah.
My second is the episode where Amuro meets his mother at the refugee camp and she is horrified to discover that he has become a killer. That is an emotional gut punch that perfectly exemplifies the theme of loss of innocence that is a recurring element in the franchise. You know what? I haven't thought about that, but that's a good one, because
that is huge.
It was shocking to watch anyway, because you're going to find in typical shows I would watch when the mother and the son are uniting in a time of war, it wouldn't just
turn. Like, I'm so glad you're okay.
Yeah.
There's none of that. She's like completely
against what he's about. Like, yeah. And it's very interesting. Like that all went down. Good one. Mm-hmm. Good one. Okay. From Digital Rex 5, in no particular order, Kira saving the Archangel. Let me figure that out.
I prefer Archangel myself, but
okay, thank you. Well, it's just there's RetroArch, but then I hear people say RetroArch, and then I'm like, what is it? Interesting. This has nothing to do with anime, yet even we don't know how to pronounce it. I don't know. But okay, so the Kira saving the Archangel with freedom and Seed, that is actually something I was thinking about too.
Because I thought it was because he died for our sins.
Well, there's that. Axis being pushed away from Earth and CCA. Yep. Amuro and Char sword fighting in the original series.
That is a good moment.
That too. Because this isn't about mechs anymore.
Yeah. You know, that, just that still frame when they're face to face, like helmet to helmet.
Yeah.
That's.
And I really like that scene in Unicorn where Minerva is casually talking with the diner owner. Yeah. So that's, you know, when she's on Earth and it's almost like a culmination of what's the point of everything happening in Unicorn. And it's almost like right there by talking to someone on Earth, you know, she's figuring it out.
Yeah.
Good ones. All right. This is good from Rubber Shark 3833. Bright Slap.
Well, yeah.
Which one? Maybe the first. Maybe the first, because that kind of set off the let the adults know it's okay to slap a child. All right. Tang Fong 7764, Hero Yui getting Gundam Wing in space with Rhythm and Motion playing in the background and Endless Waltz's peak. Could be, because everyone knows that. Like, I figure if you were to ask people, if you were to give people a whole bunch of prompts of Gundam, what would they recognize? I think most would recognize that, right? From Wing. I mean,
even just the animation of the wings, like coming out and
before each episode, and it plays that music, that dun dun dun, or whatever. That even though the show is corny, that got me in. That was like,
yeah.
All right. Altered Professor, Kira saving Archangel. Yep. Aki killing Locke. Are those characters I don't know? Aki killing Locke? Is that maybe from IBO? I haven't finished IBO, maybe. So you don't even know. Our Gundam expert. The only reason
I was going to say, like, is are we talking about Lock-On, like, from 00? Or,
but I wonder if that's, I don't know. Yeah, if anyone knows.
But Akihiro.
Oh, that's IBO.
Yeah, that is an IBO character. Thank you, Contra. Akihiro.
That's cool.
I've never heard him called Aki before.
Oh, and real quick from King Dylan, when Camille pops Quattro in the jaw and he lets a single tear loose.
The glittering tear.
Okay.
He's just young. That's all.
Let's see. Okay. Bright Slap again. New Gundam palming Char's cockpit like a basketball. Because that became a visual thing from then. When Domon and Master Asia kicked a building into the air to save themselves from a flood. Pretty amazing. I mean, there's a lot from G Gundam, I think you could say, is, you know, just the burning finger.
Or like the moment in G Gundam when you see like all of the other Gundams like snuck in.
What part?
Like where like all the Gundams are coming in and then you see like, oh, there's an RX-78 in there.
Oh,
and there's like
that's a good one.
The Easter egg Gundams.
Yeah. No, that's a good one. Let's see. Char lying to everyone saying he's Quattro Vegina and everyone believing it for a very long time. I love this. I tell you, and this is what's cool to me of being, you know, I always say recent Gundam, but it's been years. But like when I was first watching Zeta and I wouldn't look up anything online and I'm like, isn't that Char? Like it has to be, but they're not talking about it. And then the next episode, they're still not talking about it. What's going on here?
Well, and it's one of those moments where, you know how there's always like the audience insert? There's that moment when Char is meeting with Minerva and Haman and, you know, he reveals that he is Char and everyone like Oppoli and Rekawa, they're all like, ah, oh, what? No. And Camille's sitting there like, it's about time.
I loved that. Just another cool character quality of Camille, how it's like, I love how he like thinks it's kind of a teenager thing, thinks everyone else is dumb when it's just a really good character quality.
Parents just don't understand.
Yeah. Aerial squish, the hand squish. Okay. I think that could be up there because that was what everyone talked about after.
That was a pretty defining moment of that series where it was like, you know, similar to Amuro, you know, not being accepted by his mother and like the innocence lost there. Yeah. I feel like that same loss of innocence occurs at that moment in Witch for Mercury.
Good call on that because those are kind of the same things. Okay, I'm trying to get this last one down. Okay, there we go. Lock on with the 1 second Trans Am to get behind and finish off those annoying ass Innovades in 00. I keep getting reminded to go back and watch 00 again because it's been some time and it's really good. We talked about 00.
So I never finished 00 because I mean, the first three episodes kind of lost me. I don't know what it was. Like, somehow I was able to get through all of Seed and Seed Destiny, and I was like, man, I really didn't like Seed, and then I was like, Seed Destiny's fucking awesome. Like,
yeah, I know it's weird, huh? But I would say try 00 again.
I'll give it another shot.
As fun as it is to watch Seed Destiny, I consider 00 like way, 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 way. I just realized with this red shirt, I look like I just got home from my shift at Target. Or about
did
to
you,
go.
Did you stock any Gundam Universe figures? Because if so, I'm going to go.
Come up. No, and the other joke is I feel like I'm about to go on a landing party. A red shirt in Star Trek. I don't know.
You know, I'm surprised that no one commented the Gundam Epion cutting Barge in half during Gundam Wing.
Oh, yeah. We didn't get a lot. We actually got a lot of UC and Seed. Huh. That's pretty cool. So
interesting data point.
Interesting data point. Yeah. I'll send it over to Bandai so they can crumble it up and throw it. But no. What for you is a Mount Rushmore moment?
Oh man, that's a
and there would be more than one in my opinion. While you're thinking about it, I'll let you know because I've been thinking about it since I planned this episode.
Oh, there you go.
For sure, when someone brought up from the first one, like I was thinking the sword fight with Char and Amuro, but honestly, that the atmosphere drop to me, I think is more the way you explained what that really told everyone, not only what that tells people about the mobile suit, but what that tells the audience about how interesting the show is in terms of science fiction. You know, like our kids, do they understand atmosphere entry and how that works? No, but that's right. No. The other one would be the whole Quattro thing. Just Quattro as a character is a Mount Rushmore moment because that is when, to me, he is the glue between what happens in the world of UC, between Federation, Titan, like all of that. His decisions matter. And for him to be Char but not, I think is a Mount Rushmore moment.
Yeah, for sure.
And then from that, I would say I like the Kira saving the Archangel because
As far as Seed goes, that's a
cool thing because I didn't expect that. Well, I kind of did, but I didn't expect it to be as cool as it was. And then we saw it again. Spoiler alert and freedom. And then another moment for me, I don't know. Because I'm trying to think of something that's not strictly Amuro and Char legacy.
Well, so I'm going to shout out King Dylan in chat is Four's second death. And the reason I'm thinking about that is because it ties into the other one that I'm thinking of, which is Lala's death. Like nobody mentioned Lala.
That is a very
Lala's death scene is a very it's a punctuation in the series, right? Like, you know, we see Amuro's character change, we see Char's character change, we see Char's relationship with his sister completely severed as a result of that. Which is interesting because then you go back and it's like, well, this whole time he was LARPing as Quattro, he never made any effort to reconnect, reconcile with Sayla. Like that singular moment kind of defined all four characters in their respective spaces. And then like King Dylan says, when Four dies and you see Camille grieving her death and Amuro and Char watching from the sidelines, it's like, wow, the past is repeating itself, and they see this same bond of like brokenness that it kind of just echoes throughout all of UC, right? Yeah. Like that's
because even in Unicorn, that was kind of even though it was a Char clone, it was Char united with Lala, you know, trying to tell his. And it's interesting because I feel like the way UC Gundam. Uses the idea of clones. It's very, the lines are blurred because you don't really know like how much of the essence of that person is there, or is it just a vessel, or could it be that person? But from that point on, they could not be who they were, but still have the ideals, you know, like that. So,
it's like, I guess the term in literary speak would be like crossing a threshold, right? Is like,
yeah, Exactly. That, which, you know, it's a really good point, because then I'm just thinking of, like, I'm having all these thoughts in my head at once. So I'll try to, like, Double Zeta doesn't really do that, which might be the overall maybe issue or reason why people aren't as into Double Zeta, mm-hmm. other than because it's just a subtitle and not a dub. But, like, I don't think there's anything in that, and probably because it doesn't have the main characters other than Bright and Haman. You know, the other characters are new.
I mean, there's that. And then, of course, you don't have the pathos of losing a character the same way. Like, they tease Lena's death a couple of times in the series, but it doesn't actually happen. And in the same way, like, Gundam Wing doesn't have that moment. Like, there's no moment between Hero and Zex where it's like, you know, whether it's Relina dies or Noin dies, like, somebody, like, all of the characters in Gundam Wing, with the exception of Trey's, make it to the end. So there's no,
and it's always their own little thing. Like, they always have, they'll even change their ideas, but kind of do their own thing, but not necessarily based on, like you're saying, like that kind of moment where then everything is different all of a sudden. That's very interesting. I want to tell you something, because we were just talking about it. Exo Squad episode 6. The craziest thing happens that changes the rest. Like, I just watched episode 7. That was where I left off. But episode 6 completely changes the series.
Interesting.
I know. I don't want to spoil it, but it's like, I was like, that is a great idea. Again, the adult theme type of thing that I haven't seen a show do. In fact, it makes the first 5 episodes seem like a prologue. So I'll put it that way. Again, well, guys, you're going to be hearing from Exo Squad. It was X-Men for a little bit. It was Castlevania for a little bit. Now it's Exo Squad. So, yeah. All right, let's go down here. Haman Karn, anytime her name is brought up, I'm like, yeah, but I don't know what for. let's see. Okay, F91 going full tilt in the final act, leaving a trail of after image Trans Am before Trans Am. So GMKLX brought up, because I love F91. He's right. That end is insane, but the beginning is the best, I think, in my opinion, representation of a disaster scene in Gundam. Like, hey, you can tell me I'm wrong, Steven, because I know you're a hater.
No, I mean, you know, I got to hand it credit where it's due. You know, I think that throughout UC, you really don't get a lot of that mass disaster scenes. Like, you know, we hear about the colony drop and it's like in the prologue and everything, but you don't see it really happen. I think that in Double Zeta is the best time you actually get to see a colony drop fully executed and realized during Dublin.
But, yeah. And you know what? When it comes to disasters, though, I like them, even though, yeah, the colony drop is true, I like them when they're slowly unfolding. Mm-hmm. And then there's certain things that are happening. Like, if you were to watch a disaster movie, like 2012 or whatever.
The asteroid hits, but the asteroid doesn't cause the most damage. It's like the tidal wave from the asteroid that, like, it's like a knock-on effect.
And so, like, in Zeta, you had that scene where the Mark II falls into the building.
Mm-hmm.
And that's kind of like that. But in F91, you're having that happen multiple times. You're having shell casings drop on people's heads and knock
them out. There you go. Contra just... mentioned the mother getting hit in the head with the shell casing.
Yep. And so that's what I like about it, because it's like the first, I don't know, 10 or 15 minutes where people are like trying to get away and they're dying. Yeah, just thinking about it, it was like, and again, I just watched F91 like what, in 2019, I think, 2018, 2019. And I was just like, man, anime is awesome. Because they spent this first 15 minutes, as soon as you get to know the characters, now there's a disaster scene, someone dies. And yeah, that's a good one.
Yeah, we call that the inciting incident in the hero's journey.
The inciting incident. Man, you're good at this stuff. I tell you.
Hathaway does have a scene like that with the spent shell casing falling. Definitely not as brutal, not as gruesome as the one in F91. But, you know, so that's a question I have for you, Adam, is like, so the trope of like the spent shell casing from a mobile suit falling and like hitting around civilians, do you think that having it actually hit a civilian is important to convey the gravity of the situation, or is it adequately conveyed as in Hathaway, where the shell hits close to someone but doesn't kill them?
That's a good question, because then
it kind of goes back to what we were saying about like gore and things like that, right?
Yeah, because that's a good question. I think it depends who it is in the context. Here's another example of something like that. And guys, I forget which Gundam this is, so if you could remind me. It's where a disaster scene is happening, and then there's like a lady, and I think she's holding a baby, and she's like, get like, isn't she like on the side of a building, like trying to go down the stairs or something, and then you just see her get killed? Does that sound familiar? I forget which one it is. It had to be one I watched recently, because I remember seeing that and being like, oh man. And it was a UC one.
Simply New Type is saying a victory.
So it might have been Victory then.
Yeah. Which would, I mean, that checks out for Victory's level of violence.
Yeah. But it was one of those. So to answer your question, it's like, I think it depends how it's being portrayed in that context. Like, I think the shell casing falling on the lady's head and killing her, but she had a baby that was still alive and crying. So then that's what made the whole thing work. The right. thing with that scene I'm talking about where the lady's holding a baby and then like the building blows, she's like right next to her, you just see her get decimated. It's almost like she had no chance.
Man, like, Tomino really loves killing women with their babies.
Well, it's one of those things. You know what? That's interesting, because it's one of those things where you could just have it a random dude. Normally, a random dude is making a show or TV and then he's having bad guys fight bad guys. Mm-hmm. But you normally don't dwell on the woman and women and the children, because it's sad, but it's impactful. And it almost, again, like you're saying before, like it kind of informs the stakes that the show is willing to go through.
And I think that the important thing to note is that it really solidifies their position as innocent bystanders. Yeah. Like if you were to just see a random guy being crushed by a shell casing, you're like, well, he could have been a soldier, or he could have been like an insurgent or something. Like he's not an innocent person. But when you see a mother holding a child, there is no way in hell that your mind makes the connection that like, well, you know, she could have been involved somehow. It's like, no, she is 100%, and her child especially is 100% an innocent bystander that's being affected by this.
Yeah, no, that's really good. Really good. I love the disaster. Like, I almost feel like even the little, I keep talking about a story I'm writing in my head, has a disaster scene, because the idea is to set the stakes, what the characters then went through and what then they have to go through. You know, another one that kind of reminded me of was from, Stardust Memory, when Gato gets the GPO-2 and then he goes up into space and then blows up the entire fleet. Like, that's crazy. Yeah, although, let me ask you something. Did it ever seem like that had some sort of effect on the Federation afterwards? Because then they just went and mopped up Zeon Remnants.
Well, I think that what it ended up doing is it ended up triggering the... just the foundation of the Titans.
Yeah, right? that's okay. So that is a huge thing I just overlooked.
And that was that's something that like I tried to explore this in one of my tabletop games, because you know we see like kind of the dots where it's like, okay, Gato's rebellion and then the Titans form. And my dog's going crazy upstairs. Sorry. No, it's okay. But you know, in between then, and this is what I did with my tabletop group, is I was like, okay, the Titans are a new form, like a new unit within the Federation. But because of Gato's attack on the Navy at Kompei, they don't have enough soldiers to actually staff the Titans as a fighting force. And so the players get to play as like freelancers that are being not conscripted, but being invited to fight for the Titans. And during their first mission, they get the opportunity to see like, okay, well, here's what the Titans are doing. Here's what you're being ordered to do. And here is the AUG. Side are you going to side with? And so it gives you but I feel like that should have happened, right? Like the Titans seem to have all of these resources and all these people fighting for them, despite the Federation having like their entire Navy destroyed.
Yeah. And it reminded me when I was reading some of the Advance of Zeta manga. I haven't read it all, but like they introduce like these characters as all these new people coming in to join the Titans. So yeah, it's like, okay, now they're just, and I wonder if it's like the Federation. Okay. Anyone we have left, let's just send them to the Titans, since they're the ones that are actually enforcing things, building the weapons, you know, because it doesn't seem like it really is until even in Zeta, unless I'm wrong, later where the Federation is like even part of it. You know what I mean? Because it's mainly the other factions, even though the Federation is technically the Titans. That is interesting to think about. And since Kyle's here, I'll just put it out there. Did they have an issue of, what do you call it when people join a military? I don't know.
Like a recruiting drive
Maybe there was a recruiting shortage.
I don't think they have a draft in the Universal Century, but.
Yeah, well, I wonder. And I wondered because of the overpopulation, if then the numbers are just like, yeah, we'll always have enough people. I wonder.
Can you imagine being a Federation recruiter? That would see, going back to our conversation from yesterday about like a Gundam visual novel, a Gundam visual novel where you play as a Federation military recruiter and you like show up outside of high schools and you're like, you signed up for,
and you're trying to figure out, okay, who could be a new type. And so you could look at what, like they've done. Oh, this guy was in the mech.
ASVAB scores and like,
yeah, that's pretty interesting. And then like you could slap them if they get out of line.
It always goes back to the slap simulator,
but it works. Okay. Well, cool. No, this is great. Thanks guys. It was really cool to talk about, I'm calling it Mount Rushmore moments, but then it reminds me of just how cool there are moments in Gundam. And then I go rewatch things. Although,
do you think you could limit it to four if you had to?
Yeah, I could limit it to four, but mine would be very biased. It would be like anything from 0079, Zeta. I would say Sharp's Counterattack with the Axis.
Pretty much. Same here.
I wonder about like maybe Hathaway with the airplane, not the airplane. I mean, it could have been, but then the attack once they reached. Was it Davao? No. Where was it where in Hathaway he was staying? Was it the Philippines?
I think so.
Where then that attack happened that he was trying to get those people, you know, killed? Like, because that could be a big pivotal moment.
True.
In fact, see you later, Lucas Garrett. Thanks for stopping by. Oh, Philippines. Okay. But, you know, in fact, I don't... So it's interesting because Hathaway's already a book that came out. So there's potentially spoilers. I accidentally, I accidentally read the ending of Hathaway, the story. And I think
ruin it for you?
It didn't ruin it for me. It actually made me more excited about what they could potentially do. Like the fact they're going in that direction, I was like, oh, okay. Because that is a pivotal moment, I think. Do you even know what I'm talking about? I don't know.
Yeah.
Okay.
I'm picking up what you're putting down.
All right. Well, guys, that is it. Thanks a lot for joining. Today was a lot of fun. I'm going to try to come up with other things to ask at YouTube because it's really fun. I get answers that made me think, oh, I got to watch this.
This is always a fun exercise in like seeing like, what do you call it? Like just gauging the temperature
of everyone, like what people like seeing how often certain things are brought up.
Definitely.
But then also, again, there's that link in the description that allows you to submit a question, comment, a novel, an essay that will be a segment on the show. So check that out if you're interested.
Sweet.
But anything else, Steven? You all good?
No. Great show.
Yeah, great show. Thanks again, everyone in chat. You guys are awesome. We will talk later. See y'all.
Hey, watch Exo Squad.
Yeah.